This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your walk in the party. We all narcissists. Of Music, News, and Criticism, I'm your host, John Caramonica. Just come outside. The holiday season. Holiday should be a time of celebration. Maybe what you are sharing with your loved ones is the opportunity to see a concert. And maybe if you are doing that, you are encountering some bizarre things happening on the ticketing market, or maybe you just had a spectacularly smooth run at one of the many arena or stadium tours that happened this past year. It's been a bit of a highs and lows years in touring, and Ben Cesario, music business reporter at the New York Times, is here to talk about it all. Ben, what's good? Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, John.
I certainly hope they will be. TBD, quite honestly. At the beginning of the show, we were listening to Fiend by Travis Scott. I was just seeing on Twitter that Travis played Fiend 10 times in a row at the Barclays Center. Now, whether fans want to hear Fiend 10 times in a row, I can only speculate. Whether that is some kind of artistic commentary on the velocity of recent Travis Scott musical output, I also cannot speculate. But
trolling by playlists.
Yes. And perhaps something designed to generate viral content out of a live event, which is increasingly what I feel like many live events are orienting themselves around. That's something we'll get to a little bit later with some Travis-specific stuff. But I want to start by talking about the high points of the year in touring, because I feel like, obviously, last year was like the first year back, pandemic-wise, but this really felt like the year where everything really, all the systems got up to speed. The Taylor system, the Beyonce system, everybody waited, was patient, and then it was go time. Can you talk a little bit about the successes of the touring year? And also, does that reflect a broader optimism on the industry side about the touring marketplace?
Well, it was a huge year for touring in terms of dollar signs. A lot of money was made. This was like really a record-breaking year. If you look at just the touring market year by year over the last couple of decades, there was a very steady growth. This is a business that's been growing fast. And then it dipped during the pandemic. Last year, it came back to about the level where it was. So it recovered. It did a little bit better. But this year was the year that it totally broke the curve. More than $9 billion in tickets were sold for the top 100 tours. And to put that in perspective, last year, which was a really successful year, it was only about $6 billion. It is by far a record. This was like the biggest year for ticket sales by a huge margin. I wrote some numbers down here. This year was up 46% from last year and up 65% since 2019. It's one of those like Bitcoin charts where there's a bizarre spike. Last year was very successful, but if you remember, we weren't like 100% out of COVID then. There was still a little hiccups, especially in the first part of the year. And I think there were some artists who were planning big outings. Taylor, obviously, Beyonce, Bruce Springsteen was bigger than you might think. He had the number three tour last year, or this year, I'm sorry, this year, 2023. Just in terms of the raw numbers, this year was like a phenomenal success. And I think the industry is popping champagne over that. And I think what is happening right now is people are trying to figure out how much money will people really pay for tickets and how much will they put up with in terms of all the craziness of access to tickets before they somehow rebel or stop going to concerts. That's always been the worry of, okay, they paid $100 last year. Can we get them to pay $125? Can we get them to pay $175? But we're now in a situation where can people really pay $1,000 to go to any old concert?
So two questions. What percent of that revenue increase is reflective of a wide scale pricing adjustment, which is to say, hey, we used to charge 100, now we're charging 150. Is that what we're seeing? Or are we seeing of that 9 billion, 30%, 40%, whatever it is, just Taylor and Beyonce?
You're exactly right about that. I also took note of those numbers. And we did not discuss this, John.
No, we're just freestyling. This is just we're just when you sit in the light of all this information, sometimes just goes.
We're just like twins. We speak a certain unspoken language.
Big facts.
Of the gain this year, like the amount above last year's, it was almost $3 billion. And of that gain, Taylor and Beyonce are just over 50%. So if Taylor had not toured, that $9.2 billion would be about $8.1 billion. It would be a lot less, but it would still be way up. A really good chunk of the increase is just Taylor and Beyonce. But I think that we can't really attribute the whole thing to them. A lot of just the entire like economic engine of live music has been driven by price increases little by little, or maybe more than a little by little over the years. And I think everybody can relate to that of just what you paid this year versus what you might have paid for the same artist 5 years ago. It's going to be a lot more.
Do you get the sense that touring companies, performers are trying to match increased pricing with a more comprehensive, dynamic product? Or are people just going to pay $150 where they used to pay $100 to watch the same performer do the same show effectively they did 5 years ago? Is the growth only on the price side, or is there development in the product side as well?
I think that the band that's doing essentially the same show that they did 4 years ago and 8 years ago and 9 years ago, they've doubled their ticket price, right? ZZ Top's show is not any different now than it was 10 years ago, but they're charging more for their ticket. There has been technical innovation in concert production over the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years, maybe a little less. Pre-pandemic, I thought we were already seeing some really interesting stuff with set design. Adele's tour for 25, I thought was like pretty impressive in terms of its staging. U2, which is, they've always been interested in this. They were doing these full stage video projections that I thought were pretty cool. And now they're with the Sphere. I think Taylor's tour was quite impressive in terms of its production. I think I didn't see Beyonce live. I really wish I had. But from everything I saw, it looked totally phenomenal about the visuals for that. I think for that uppermost echelon of artists, I think they probably have upped the game in terms of what they're delivering for a ticket that might be $700-$800.
I think a lot about concert going as luxury good. And I don't think I thought about concert going as luxury good, I don't know, 15 years ago. Really, obviously, the best tickets for the biggest tours were always extremely expensive. But, you know, if you wanted to just see like a Madonna show at a big venue, you could get a $40 ticket somewhere in a bad seat and you can see a Madonna show. That no longer feels like an option for the big stars. And I think as the conception of a night out at the tour becomes more and more of a luxury access point and the price points go so much higher, I do feel eventually that pressure is going to like reverse apply back onto not just Taylor and Beyonce, but the second and third tier artists who are going to be like, I have to deliver thing if I'm asking people to pay this amount because they're telling me, hey, I'm paying this amount. I want to show, like, I want to feel like I earned it, or rather, I want to feel like you earned it, the artist. So I do imagine, and I also feel like with some of the bigger tours, and Travis, I think, is probably a good example of this. It's like you have the festivalication of individual tours, which is people have become acclimated to the kind of bells and whistles that come with big multi-artist festivals, and there's art installations and all kinds of visual tricks. And I think people are expecting that more on an individual artist level, especially of the biggest acts.
I think that's true. And it may also be partly dependent on those artists, because I think Travis and maybe Beyonce too, we think of them as very multimedia ambitious creators. And so we would probably be bored or disappointed if we just simply saw them standing there singing. Like we think of their art as being highly complex and multimedia. So that makes sense. But I do think that there will be pressure on artists to justify the price that they're charging. And that could be partly the high-tech quality of the production. It could also just be what it feels like to be in that room. I know that we're going to talk about the Sphere. You went, I didn't. But I feel like that is a moment. That feels like it's really raising the stakes. And that's something that only that particular venue can deliver on. But I do think that's going to change expectations about just what people will want when they spend serious money to get into a concert.
Yes, I agree. And I will say the one mild counter argument to what we're saying, the Drake tour this year, which I was actually surprised at how relatively lo-fi it was. It's mostly just him. There's a little bit of visual trickery, and the concession to, like, I'm doing a big show. Like, there are these, I don't even know what you'd call them, statues or flying figures, like balloon figures that kind of move around over him at various points. His stage is in the center, but there's very little that's going on. He's not doing a lot of trickery. He's mostly just rapping and singing in a square in the center of the arena. There's other stuff happening around him, but it felt very incidental to me. So I thought the Drake tour was an interesting counterpoint, but almost every other tour I saw this year, I felt was hitting from like multiple angles. And we touched on social media and the importance of social media a minute ago. But I think increasingly what these artists are understanding is that the show lives in the stadium or in the arena, but increasingly it lives in people's phones, IG storying, TikToking it, and little micro moments that travel really well on those platforms are just as important, if not more so, than the actual concert experience standalone.
And part of that is just the communication of it to the wider audience, and to have a conversation outside the building that continues on social media there. And obviously that's going to be really important. And so it's interesting that we don't see a lot of like negative storylines from that. Like we see when something is cool, but if something's lame, I don't feel like we see it as much. Maybe that's just the network effect of social media, that like it amplifies the cool image.
Fan energy is likely to amplify the good stuff. Also, I'm thinking of Nell, someone who works with us on Deluxe, but freelance, does some writing for the paper, wrote a piece this year about kind of the meta streamers of the Taylor and Beyonce tours. And I think that's interesting because I think the logical endpoint of a concert used to be to have the most effective presentation for the 20,000, 50,000, whatever, however many people are in that room or in that venue. Now it's, can this concert reach all the fans? And it requires the labor of people who are sharing social media, people who are doing these meta streaming things. It requires all this extra labor. But now a concert done correctly and spread correctly can hit way more than 50,000 people. It could hit a million people, multiple millions of people, because of the viral amplification factor. And that's interesting to see, because I think it's changed the nature of what concert making is a little bit.
But I think there was iconography that was associated with the concert going back many decades that would outlive it. There's just, think about all the like album covers and music videos and photos and everything of just the stadium full of fans, like with their hands in the air. And you're just seeing like a mass of humanity that are there for the event. That was part of the image that any artist wanted to see communicated. And then the like wall of amps behind them, or like Bruce Springsteen with his fist up in front of the screaming fans in the front rows. I think there were like some of those images that tended to get repeated over and over. And like that was the image of what a cool concert was in decades past. And I'm not sure what it is exactly at this moment, but I always think about just stuff like Taylor, like diving into the fake pool of her stage and the images radiating outward around the floor, and how like how cool that is to see it. If you saw the show, you saw that from one angle, but then on social media, you see it from different angles. You see the sort of like radiating waves. Like I didn't see that when I saw her play. So that was cool to see that. A lot of that technological video imagery that just wasn't possible decades before, I feel like that's becoming part of the show that people take home, just like you're saying, on social media. And I think that's interesting how that's changing, because the pictures of the Taylor tour where you're just seeing like the stadium with 60,000 people on it aren't that interesting. The ones that are really interesting are like are her interacting with her own image behind her and that kind of stuff.
For a minute when you were talking about older concerts, I thought you were going to talk about the flying pig with some Pink Floyd.
We can get to that.
I thought that's what you were going to cut. I just, because that's like a good example, Pink Floyd, and a good example of, I think, a band, from what I can gather, I've not been to a Pink Floyd concert, but tried to have something more than just band playing on the stage.
Sure.
And I'm sure you can go to any number of Pink Floyd laser shows in an ongoing way if you wish to continue to experience the music in that format. This actually maybe is a good pivot to talk about the Sphere and experiential concert production. You know, you too, I am old enough that I went to the Zoo TV tour. U2 is a band that has always been preoccupied with quote unquote futurist presentations of concerts, and they've been doing versions of it. It's not surprising that they chose to inaugurate the Sphere. So the Sphere, if people don't know, Sphere is a venue in Vegas. It is built by Jim Dolan, who is in charge of the Garden in Radio City here in New York. And it is more or less, it's a sphere that's sitting kind of in the ground. What you're really seeing is like two-thirds of a sphere. The entire exterior is an LED screen, and you can see what's on that screen from all over Vegas, different angles, different things. And the entire interior is, or at least the back half of it, is an LED screen. And I don't know, there's a lot of hullabaloo about the Sphere. It's a good name. It's a good marketing tactic. I was maybe a little less impressed, but the execution of the thing, it does speak to this sense that a conventional concert may not be enough. You've got to do more. You've got to lightly nauseate your audience with visuals that are moving in an unconventional manner on this all overall screen. That's actually, listen, all right, let's listen to, they played all of Octoon Baby, but let's listen to U2's Mysterious Ways, one of the songs on the set list.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Hi, it's Samantha Shea from Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. We all know those people who are simply impossible to shop for. At Wirecutter, we have a huge collection of gift guides to help you find the perfect present. We can help you find a gift for the indoorsy type, a gift for the coffee lover looking to try a new bean, something that's nice but not too nice for the new person you're seeing, the best packing cubes for frequent travelers, for the music-loving dad, try a Thelonious Monk album. We believe there's a perfect gift for everyone, and Wirecutter can help you find it. Check out all our gift guides at nytimes.com/giftguides.
You haven't been to the Sphere. Tell me a little bit about your perception of what role the Sphere is playing in terms of the evolution of the live experience.
I think the perspective in the industry was curious but skeptical going into it. There's a long backstory here. It was hugely expensive for Mr. Dolan and his company. I think the ultimate price tag was over $2 billion, which is just an insane amount of money for a building, for a venue. And as you said, like, there was a lot of hype, but I think people were wondering if it would live up to the hype and what it would mean for them. I think the reviews were mostly positive, at least as far as the industry goes, that like people were really wowed by it. And I think it was like quite an eye-opening thing. From everyone I've talked to, they went to it, they came back, they went, holy cow, that was really something. I think it's a very rare example of the ante being upped in terms of just simply what a venue is, what the production is.
Am I the only dissenter, Ben? Am I the only dissenter?
Well, okay, so I guess my question for you is, was it the venue itself that disappointed you? Or was it the question of the artist's presentation within it and the impact on the artist? Because that's one of the things I wonder is, what position does this put the artist in? Like, are they a secondary attraction compared to this fancy building with glowing lights and 10,000 speakers all over the place?
Okay, two separate questions, two separate answers. To answer the second question first, yes. It could have been me and you playing on that stage, doing YouTube covers. You know what I mean? Like, the lighting was not dialed in to really focus on the band. The stage itself, or at least in this setting, like, I imagine it'll change depending on who's performing, but the stage itself was not that big. And at least the way the Sphere is set up, if you're in the fourth tier, you're still getting a pretty good view of the big screen, and you maybe aren't even paying attention to the stage.
Mm-hmm. I heard some complaints that the worst seats were actually kind of in like the back of the front section, because there's like an overhang and you don't get to see what's on the ceiling. So the people that were way up got to see the largest expanse of the interior.
I think that's correct. I also think being relatively low, like, there's like general admission on the floor, and then I was in the first seated tier. I could sense both how big the screen felt and how small the band felt.
Yeah.
I think if you were sitting high up, it might not have occurred to you, because you'd be like, well, I'm sitting high up anyway, so I don't expect the band to be that present. But on the first tier, where you would expect the visual presentation of the band itself to be impactful, it really wasn't. So I do think it doesn't do amazing things for the artists who are on stage. I mean, obviously, I think Fish is going to be in there next. We'll see how, well, no, I won't see, because I'm not going to go. But someone will see if it's different from you too. That's one thing. The bigger question, and I thought about the Sphere a lot watching Beyoncé Renaissance film, because one of the things that the Renaissance film does is really try to capture just how massive the scale of the stage is. And obviously, she's playing stadiums. You have to have a massive stage. I get it. But I'm not convinced that the Sphere does anything that a great stadium tour stage doesn't do, except traps you inside of it. And maybe that's the thing. And I don't know, maybe if you're like on psychedelics or something, maybe it's super rad. Personally, I got nauseated at least twice from the way the visuals were being displayed, because things are moving at a speed that's like a little out of step with how the actual human beings in the building are moving. And if you're just looking at it from a little bit of the wrong angle, you get disoriented. I didn't feel that they maximized what the Sphere as visuals could do. One thing that's that big shows, especially arena, indoor arena shows, have been doing recently is trying to take advantage of effectively the airspace over the crowd, whether it's floating artists out over the crowd or floating like Drake did with balloon figures or whatever. But you're taking advantage of that. Theoretically, it's dead space, but they're finding a way to use it. There's a lot of dead space in the Sphere and it's not used. And I think I was extremely aware of how empty a lot of that space felt.
I mean, it'd be interesting if somebody else cracks the code at some point and is able to use all of the high-tech imagery and the sound in a way that's more effective, or find a way to use that interior space. But I did think about that as I saw some of the first images coming out of there, reading some of the reviews of just, it felt like there was a danger of the artist itself, the artist themselves being dwarfed by the technical gimmickry of the venue. And I think that's a new situation that most musicians have never had to deal with. I think that's interesting, but I also think, who knows? Like, maybe somebody will totally kill it. Maybe Fish will be the one. Maybe if Beyonce ever does it, she could find something interesting to do. The other side of the Sphere that isn't talked about as much is just the destination festival type aspect to it. They were selling travel packages because it's Vegas. So people were not only buying a ticket, they were spending several thousands of dollars to get the hotel room and the meal tickets or whatever. That already is going to cut a huge amount of the audience out. If you're dying to see Fish and you have the money, you will go. But a lot of people won't go because it's going to cost them $5,000.
I think that's the other thing of like the festival location of a live experience is that it's no longer just a concert ticket. Obviously, the Sphere you have to travel to, but even if you're going to the Beyonce or Taylor show that's in your hometown or in your near, you know, an hour's drive away, it's the merchandise. It's the licensed cup for the Diet Coke. It's there are so many additional touch points that it just feels very quaint. I mean, you know, sometimes I feel like we sit on this show and be like, it used to be this other way, but it really did used to be this other way. And it is not that other way anymore. You want it to be one, as Marlo famously said on The Wire, you want it to be one way, but it's the other way. Given that, when there are pressure points that emerge, you were saying that like a lot of the positive stuff travels really well on social media from big tours. But I also think we saw some examples this year when there were some pressure points that were traveling almost as well. And the thing that I'm thinking of is this kind of head scratcher with dates on the Travis Scott tour, where people were posting TikToks and saying, hey, it's 3 hours until this Travis Scott show and you can buy hundreds of tickets for $10 on various resale websites. And I don't think anybody really did like a deep dive on why that might be, but I wonder if we could talk a little bit about, did something happen this year where certain artists either misjudged their demand, or is this a secondary market issue? How did we arrive at this? And there's obviously plenty of people who paid whatever they paid for Travis and had a great time. But I was struck that for a stretch of time, maybe a month ago, I was seeing TikToks like this pretty regularly on my for you page.
Yeah, this is like one of the riddles of touring this year, that like Travis Scott in particular. And so just to explain it, he goes on this tour. It starts in October, and eventually his team is hyping this as sold out. There were like numerous press releases and posters up in places saying sold out tour. But if you went to Ticketmaster and you scanned the available tickets for venues, and for those who haven't done it, Ticketmaster now has a way for you to zoom in on the seating chart and you'll see dots. And if you see blue dots, then that means that those are the primary tickets that are for sale, meaning the like the box office. And if you see red dots, those are the resale tickets. So those are ones that either are a regular old fan or really more likely a professional scalper who used a bot or something to get the ticket and is now trying to scalp it for a profit. And we were just seeing these like weird Christmas trees of these different colored dots, where I remember that the tour opened in North Carolina And there were two dates in a row, I think in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I remember thinking like, huh, that's weird. Two dates in Raleigh at an arena. And the first date was filled with red dots. The second date was filled with blue dots. So what that means almost certainly is that they, by the way, so the second date was added after they initially put the first date on sale. So what this means is that they sold a bunch of tickets, and a huge proportion of the people who bought those tickets tried to flip them and scalp them. And so somebody back at the mothership of his tour, and his promoter is Live Nation. Off the top of my head, I don't know who the agent is. The professionals who are monitoring all this stuff looked at that first date and said, wow, we sold a lot of tickets. There seems to be a lot of demand there. Let's add a second date. So they add the second date, but then nobody buys them. And the reason nobody buys them is either because nobody really wants to see the concert, or because so many of the people who bought the first one were scalpers who never intended to go, and they don't want to take the risk on buying tickets for a second show because they still haven't sold their scalp tickets for the first one. So there's this like pollution of the information that's telling the artist and their team what they need to know about the demand. And in fact, Travis canceled the second show on the day of with no explanation. And there were a couple of other dates on the tour that were canceled, in some cases with explanation, in some cases not. And this is a weird one because it's not super clear like where to point the blame. Is it Live Nation's fault for misreading the demand? Is it the artist's fault for trying to sell too many shows? Is it the scalper's fault for just going like hog wild over this? There was an article on, there's a new website called 404 that was started by some of the people from Vice Motherboard who have done a lot of stuff about the scalping market. And they did track down that there was like a sort of like investor group, like one of these people that like does these meme stocks. So there were like, there was a group that communicates on social media and they say, hey, Travis Scott is touring. Like they had a semi-organized way to buy a bunch of tickets and try to scalp them. And they saw this as no different from just like doing one of his sneaker drops or something. And, but they all took a bath on it, right? They're dummies. They don't know anything about the music business. They don't know anything about the artist probably. And they just saw him as, hey, here's somebody whose fans we can exploit easily. Let's do it. Clearly they screwed it up. But I think the bigger question is, why didn't the professionals in the room figure that out faster? Why couldn't they stop it? How did they fall for such an obvious ploy by hobbyist scalpers? That's my read on it. There may be other reads too.
Travis obviously is in a uniquely tenuous position because of what happened in Astroworld. Obviously, several people died at the Astroworld Festival a couple of years ago.
10 people.
And this has hit 10 people. And this is the first Travis outing since then. So I think on the one hand, they think that there's a sense of pent-up demand. And there's also, because of Travis has always been an incredibly dynamic live performer. And I think in a lot of ways, Travis became as big as Travis is because of the intensity of the live shows, which I think a lot of rappers are then trying to emulate on the backside of that. A lot of the things I think he was doing like three tours ago are now becoming more standard. So I imagine the need collectively for the Travis Scott Incorporated business to have a successful live run probably trumped looking at the warning signs. I think there's a sense of, oh, there is demand. Okay, let's keep feeding it and let's just make it as big as possible. And I imagine that light hubris is what led to the thing that you're describing.
That's very possible. And like they're paying the price for it in the form of bad social media press. There are hundreds of fans or more. I've seen a lot of them, but probably not as much as you, of just people saying, huh, like what's up with this? And No artist wants to see their tickets being hawked at a fire sale price, because that's the market giving you a big thumbs down, saying you're not worth $300, you're worth $10. That's about the worst for Travis. Obviously, there were some other pretty bad things that happened with him, but in terms of fans talking about your show and talking about whether they are excited or not, them highlighting really low prices for your show is an embarrassment. And so that's bad news. But I think all of this, I think Travis became the poster boy for this, but he's not the only one. It's happened with some other tours. And I think part of it has to do with just this chaotic, untamed situation that we're in with ticketing now. And it's really hard to know if who the bad actors are, and whether the artists, and whether Ticketmaster, and whether the other power players in the industry, are they doing what they should be doing? Are they taking advantage of the chaos? And it's really hard to know about that. But I think the result that you see is that fans are like really fed up with it. I wrote about the Bruce Springsteen tour because this was maybe back in April, I think. Bruce is somebody who like famously made this a moral issue, who said, I'm not going to charge my fans too much money. I'm going to keep the price low. I know that they would pay more. I know that the scalper scumbags are going to make the money, but I don't want to be the scumbag. I want to be the man of the people. And so for years, he vastly underpriced his tickets. And I think he saw over the years that he was just leaving a lot of money on the table, and that he was paying for the scumbags to put for their pool or their new car. And so he raised his prices a little. He got caught, you know, there's this thing, dynamic pricing, of like they like kind of the Uber surge pricing, but it appears that was a pretty small amount of the actual tickets, but the screen grab got grabbed, and that's what became the story. So he got a lot of egg on his face for that. But that's the situation that we're seeing now, is like the feeling that, is my favorite artist gouging me? Are they taking advantage of me? Why do I have to jump through all these hoops? What do I have to do to just be a fan? It just feels like a lot of work. You feel exploited. My theory is that people are willing to just put up with a huge amount of hell for the maybe couple of artists that they really love, but probably not for all the rest.
The questions around retirement have gotten tiring. Instead of, have you saved up enough? Shouldn't they be asking, what is it that you love to do? You're not slowing down, so your retirement plan should be more of an action plan, a hiking plan, a golf plan. Lincoln Financial has the products to help protect and grow your financial future. Make your pastimes last a lifetime at lincolnfinancial.com/action plan. Lincoln Financial Group, marketing name for Lincoln National Corporation and its insurance companies and broker-dealer affiliate, Lincoln Financial Distributors, Inc., 2024, Lincoln National Corporation.
Okay, this might be an interesting pivot point to talk about the recent legislation that was passed to combat fees, because I think so much of the uproar about the fan experience at concerts or in relation to acquiring concert tickets has boiled down to an optics problem about Ticketmaster fees. And I feel like Ticketmaster is like an easy
target. Yeah.
Target. Yeah.
You're a boogeyman.
Absolutely. And it was interesting to see Zach Bryan last year and this year try to go around Ticketmaster and having a verified service where you can't sell your ticket. If you need to resell your ticket, you can only resell it at face value. I'm definitely the proud owner of a Zach Bryan All My Homies Hate Ticketmaster t-shirt. It's just, you got to have that for the archives.
But he capitulated. So right? His tour this year was at Ticketmaster venues. He gave up.
Damn it. All right, then that's really an archival piece that I got that I should really, then the value is going to go up on. Can you talk a little bit about what was going on with this legislation that was passed pretty recently? And does it have any actual meaningful impact on prices or fan experience?
No legislation has actually been passed yet. It was just introduced. But since, if you remember, the Senate held hearings in January about Ticketmaster, and Taylor Swift was basically the reason for that. All the bad publicity about the Taylor Swift ticketing. And so we saw senators from both parties really go wild with that, beat up on Ticketmaster. There was a lot of political theater happening there. And since that, there's been several bills that have been introduced. I think three in total in the Senate and two in the House, if I have that right. And the most recent one in the Senate was introduced by Cornyn, a Republican from Texas, and Klobuchar from Minnesota. And it has some basic consumer protections in there. Things like when you buy a ticket, it should display the fees. It should tell you where in the house the seats actually are. It should tell you whether it's a primary ticket or a secondary, meaning a resold ticket. Some pretty basic stuff. And there's also things about penalties for breaking those rules. And years ago, there was a law passed called the Bots Act that criminalized using a bot to buy a ticket. But that law is basically toothless. It has rarely ever been enforced. People say it's only been enforced one time, but I don't know if that's literally true. So there was language in the bill that strengthened it. But I think what we're seeing also is that the sausage making of the lobbying process is at work here. And there's already some stuff in the bill that seems like it's there to protect the secondary ticket marketplaces, which are like StubHub and Vivid Seats and SeatGeek and some of the other ones. They're very powerful. They are pretty good at lobbying. And for example, in the Klobuchar-Cornyn bill, they banned what's called speculative ticket sales. And that's when the scalper posts a listing that says Taylor Swift ticket, $10,000, but they don't actually have the ticket. They're just trying to get somebody to pay the $10,000 and betting that they will come up with the ticket in the next 6 months before the show actually happens and deliver it to them. So they banned that, but they allowed what's called concierge services, which are like you can pay that secondary platform to wait in line for you to get the ticket ahead of time. And it seems to me that those are obviously there to protect those interests. The bill also does nothing to give artists control over whether their tickets can be sold in the secondary market, because a lot of artists actually oppose that, but it's really hard for them to do much about it. And The Cure tried to do this, and it was, you know, it sort of worked, sort of didn't. So I think that's showing us that, first of all, Washington doesn't really understand this. And I think that there's a danger that they may just be playing a political game because, as you said, like Ticketmaster is a very easy target for them. It's very popular with all constituents to see them hold Ticketmaster to account and to yell at them and grandstand. But it's another thing to really dig in and try to figure out what is the best deal for those voters, for the consumers, and what's fair in the business. And I think that there is a risk that this won't turn out well in the end, that it could end up being controlled or compromised by corporate interests like most legislation is. So we'll see. I mean, I think most people think this is a good step. It's good to have some of those basic protections in. But the thing that artists mostly complain about is they want to be able to control how their tickets are sold and where they are sold. And this doesn't really give them that control.
Also, I think, and this came up, I think, the last time we had a touring specific episode, which is inflation is up. Touring concerts are increasingly a luxury goods. Prices are going to go up. A lot of the pushback that you get, especially like on the Taylor tour and so on and so forth, are for people encountering, maybe they're younger, but they're encountering their first eye gouging price for a show. And maybe over time, it will become clear that, unfortunately, that is where the market sets the price, for better or worse. And I don't like it. You don't like it. I don't, you know, when I pay for shows, it doesn't thrill me. And there's definitely shows that I choose not to pay for. If it's a type show I might buy a ticket to, there's definitely shows I choose not to pay for, because for me, it's not worth whatever the money is. And I'm sure you feel the same.
Absolutely. It saddens me that what used to basically be a relatively cheap form of entertainment has gotten to the point where even I, as a grown up with a job, feel like, can I really justify paying $300 for a concert ticket? I have a family. I have a kid. I'm not likely to do that. And I think it does make it harder for fans to enjoy live music. One of the things that we heard about a few years ago was that in changing the pricing of something like an arena, the talking point a few years ago was about like increasing the number of pricing levels so that they would sell the front rows and the best seats for more money so that they could discount the nosebleed seats and the ones in the back. But we haven't really seen that happen. For the biggest shows, they're squeezing every dollar out of every seat that they can. $80 nosebleeds to me feels like a really unfortunate thing. And I understand that artists need to make their money there. And I won't begrudge an artist for wanting to make all the money they can. But I do think it raises the question of whether you are serving your fans by charging what the market will bear.
Although this is a good place to close on, which is I'm struck by, and we talked about the kind of meta streamers before, which is, hey, Taylor's playing in Pittsburgh tonight. I can sit on my computer and watch someone streaming either live from the show or aggregating various streams a la the Frank Ocean Coachella set and experience it that way. But with Taylor and Beyonce making tour film a separate business, a separate revenue stream, what I think that has effectively done is it said, yes, the live experience, that's the true luxury experience. If you are an A1 fan, if you can afford it, come and be in the room. But there are millions more fans, and why not capture their revenue? And so it's actually turning a concert into a multi-tiered experience, and only one of the tiers is actually live. But you can capture so much additional revenue for people who did not go to the show or who wish to relive it by putting in the theater. And I think the spread of the quote unquote live experience into non-live media is really where these things are heading. You have a luxury product that's like very intense if you're there, but it's still available subsequent to the live event. And I know, because I also groan about $200 for such and such seats, et cetera, but there's some small part of it. I can catch it on YouTube, or I can catch it in the movie theater. And maybe that softens the blow a little bit.
I think that it'll be interesting to see whether that really plays out, because I think that there's something so unique about Taylor and Beyonce that, and these tours that they did this year, where the urgency to be there and the meaning that was attached to the live spectacle and all the rituals attached to it, the dressing up, all that, that was something that was so special and so in demand that I do think that there were millions of people who couldn't get in. And so they can, so that there is a sort of second tier experience. And I know like friends who have younger kids who they went to see the movie and they loved it. And that was a perfectly good experience. But I honestly don't know how many other artists can do that.
You mean there's not going to be a military gun Alamo Draft House night? Is that what you're telling me?
Maybe not.
Oh, well.
Coming out of the pandemic, there was a lot of talk about, will these live stream things survive? Can we keep them going? Maybe an artist will do the show and do streams. Maybe they'll send the stream to another continent that they can't tour at, and then they'll go tour there next time. And like, none of that happened, because for 99% of it, the live event was all that people were really interested in. And I feel like there's something about the Taylor and Beyonce tours that you were just grateful for any contact. And I don't know how many other artists can do that. We'll see. I don't know. It'll be interesting.
Okay. I will close by saying that if anybody from Metrograft or Alamo Drafthouse is listening, I'd be very happy to curate a mini festival or an ongoing series of live concert tours. So just get at us, podcast@nytimes.com, or hit me in the DMs. Ben Cesario, have a blessed holiday.
You too, John.
Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. Also catch us on YouTube, youtube.com/podcast, where me and Joe are on video in loud chairs. Subscribe anywhere you get your audio content. That is Spotify, Apple, YouTube, etc. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord or podcast Facebook. Get stickers or one of the remaining shirts for a loved one. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Ed Stepper Media. We'll be back next week. Let's go out with the Taylor performance of Dear John, one of one. Clutch your heartstrings.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.